We're talking today with Andy Dahl. He is Assistant Collections Manager for Zoology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science about the intersection of animal health, animal diet, and ecology. Andy Dahl, first tell me a little bit about what you do here at the museum.
I help take care of zoology's vast research collection. We have specimens in 5 major collections. We have mammals and birds and insects, entomology. We have an arachnology collection, our spiders and mites and scorpions, and then also a large marine vertebrate collection. I help with the day-to-day care, maintenance, preservation of all that material.
What's important about this collection is that different scientists can borrow certain animals and use them for stable isotope signature analysis. What does it determine?
You can learn about the food that they were eating when those tissues were grown. That can also tell you about where they were when those tissues were grown. It can inform patterns of migration.
So if I plucked a hair off my head, you could tell what I've eaten over the last, couple of years?
You can make some inferences about it. So if you were a vegetarian versus a carnivore, we could definitely make some educated statements about that. If you were eating in a particular part of the world, if you went traveling, we might be able to pick that up. There's differences in isotopes within the water that we drink, and that's tied to location. So there's a lot you can learn from that.
Now, I have long hair. How far back can you go?
Growth rates vary between different individuals and different species, so the amount of time contained within a single hair can vary. And isotopes are actually different forms of elements. I've specifically worked with carbon and nitrogen. There's researchers that study hydrogen and oxygen for similar kinds of work. So it's different masses of these elements. So you may have heard of carbon-14. Mm-hmm. That's how they do radiocarbon dating to determine age, oftentimes fossils and other things like that. That's an unstable isotope. That's a radioactive isotope that decays over time. Well, stable isotopes, they are stable, so they don't degrade over time, so they're fixed. By studying the amounts of the different forms of stable isotopes, so carbon, for example, has carbon-14 as the radioactive, but then it also has carbon-12, which is the most common form, and then carbon-13, which is the one that we kind of focus on for these stable isotope analyses.
So if we're looking at carbon-14 and carbon-12 would have a different number of neutrons.
Yeah. So carbon-12 is the most prevalent form. Carbon-14 has 2 additional neutrons.
So if you were to test my hair for what I ate over the last year, what precisely would you be looking at?
We'd be looking at the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13. Carbon-13 is like a fraction of a percent of the amount of carbon-12, but that fraction can vary based on what you're eating or where you're eating at.
So I went to Pakistan this time last year. Could you pick that up?
Possibly. It's difficult with today's widely distributed food supply, but there might be some indications that you were eating stuff that was grown locally in Pakistan.
Nice. A lot of spicy goat. So that might turn up.
Yeah, you could find some spicy goat.
So, this isotope analysis, it can give important clues on the health of the ecology. You've done some really interesting research on sea lions. Tell us a little bit about that research.
Stellar sea lions are apex predator in the Pacific Ocean. They range from Baja California all the way up the coast to Alaska, and then they actually are found in the Eastern Hemisphere. My research focused mainly on the populations that live up in Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. They eat just about everything. They're generalist predators, so they eat a lot of different kinds of fish and crustaceans and cephalopods and things like that. Stellar sea lions experienced a significant population decline somewhere in the early 1970s. Population estimates as compared to the 1950s had dropped around 80%. Something was severely disturbed in that ecosystem. A lot of the assumptions was that it was diet-based, so something changed in their diet, available diet resources, and that caused their population to decline. They weren't eating the same kind of stuff they had been.
Have they rebounded, or are they still in that state of decline?
Some of them have, and some of them haven't. There's kind of 2 distinct population segments that we talk about management. There's the eastern population and the western. The eastern is from like southeast Alaska and down the coast, and that population has rebounded. They're increasing. They were actually removed from the endangered species list in 2013. But the western population segment from pretty much out in the Aleutian Islands, mm-hmm. From Alaska, they have continued to decline. So there's still something off out there.
What was the type of research that you did to help determine why that population is imperiled?
Initially, we began investigating the diets of pregnant females and gestating female sea lions to better understand the pressures that their pups may be undergoing and how that might affect their subsequent survival rates. For this study, they were obtaining whiskers from the pups and not the mothers, so we inferred the mother's diet through the pup's whiskers. To do that, the pups, when they're born on the shorelines, and they're stuck on shore for a while until they're big enough and capable enough to go out in the ocean. So the teams of field researchers went out and they just capture the pups when they're kind of stuck on the rocks.
And the moms are probably out fishing,
yeah.
And they just clipped off a little whisker?
They actually pluck them.
Okay.
That way we can get the entire length of the whisker. It's the whole length of the whisker can tell you a whole lot. It's that time series of diet. We actually, for this study, to learn what was happening during gestation, we were concerned with the tips, but the entire length of the whisker was used for different analyses.
That makes sense, because we've got the baby seal in utero, what she or he was getting through the placenta, through the mom's diet, and then once out, through the mom's milk.
Yep. Yeah, and you can see the shift in isotope signatures. So when the pups are gestating, they're getting nutrients directly from the mother. It's more like they're a part of the mother. They're getting diet that's been unprocessed. However, once they're born and they start feeding on milk, as far as their isotopes are concerned, it's like they're feeding on their mother. So they've jumped up a trophic level on what they're feeding on. So you can see that birth event. And then subsequently, you can see the weaning when they stop feeding on milk and start eating actual fish.
So they pluck these whiskers out. They do an initial analysis and then send you the data.
Correct.
How did you process that data?
Most of our analysis were done in R. It's a coding program for analyzing data.
To get the initial ratio of carbon 12 and 13, did they put it through a kind of
mass spectrometer? It's a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer,
which determines the weight, and the 13 is going to be a tiny bit heavier than the 12.
Yeah, so essentially it vaporizes that little piece of whisker and then sends it through these tubes to separate it and then whips it past a magnet. And the heavier one bends a little bit less than the lighter atoms, and this machine can detect those little differences.
That's amazing. And then they sent you the data, and then through your coding program, you were able to infer the diet of these animals?
Yeah. You can then take this to infer health consequences, because certain prey items are presumed to be more healthy than others. They have better protein or better fats for the growing pups.
Okay. So fish, you talked about cephalopods, which would be octopus, cuttlefish, that
squid,
kind of thing,
yeah.
Squid. What did you infer about this particular population?
For the diets of the pregnant females, we are able to detect a difference between the populations in their diets. So the populations in southeastern Alaska that have been removed from the endangered species list, they feed on a lot of what we call forage fish. So little eulachon and capelin, which are tiny little like sardine kind of fish, which are very high in fat. So they're a really good nutrient-rich prey source. That eastern population has a lot of them in their diet. The eastern and central Aleutian populations have a more mixed diet, so a little bit less of that and more of the kind of higher trophic level predatory fish. And then in the far western population of the Aleutians, which is really has the most dramatic population declines, their diets consist primarily of Atka and squid. That confirms the diet estimates based on scat studies. So lots of researchers have gone and collected scat droppings on the shorelines and inferred diets. However, we were able to document higher percentage of squid because that's the soft tissues of that don't really make it through the digestive tract, so it's hard to document that presence. Those are believed to be less nutritious food items.
So you were able to infer from this data that the healthier population was eating a lot of these smaller fatty fish and that the least healthy population was eating a lot of squid. Assuming that before 1970, when the population began to decline, those diets would have been more similar.
That's the presumption, yes.
So there's a sense that these small fish are not thriving in that part of the ecosystem. And so your data then could go to help ecologists figure out how they can recreate some balance in that ecosystem with regard to these smaller fish that give great nutrition to sea lions.
Yeah, so really the intent of this study is to provide more information to the fisheries management industry and the marine biologists that manage populations up there. Yeah, so it's a very complicated system on the management of fisheries up there. It's also a very sensitive issue. around the Aleutians, there's lots of protected areas, primarily to protect the sea lions. But the ocean is a big and really dynamic place with lots of different interactions between the food web. Even though you're protecting a small area around the islands where these sea lions spend a lot of their time when they're not foraging, what goes on outside of those areas can really impact what's happening inside those protected areas. So it might be helpful to limit certain types of fishing outside of those areas of certain prey species at certain times of year, even could make a difference. We were just trying to provide some more information for them to make those decisions.
I understand that you just got published.
The initial work I was doing was looking at those pup whiskers and trying to see what their moms were eating. This second paper involved looking at temporal changes in diet in adult females. So we were actually analyzing the female whiskers this time. Removes one of the steps of potential confusion when you're trying to infer diets through multiple pieces of food being transferred from diet to the actual tissue.
So you're looking at it as season long with these animals.
Multiple years.
Multiple years. So you have a sense that during the spring, they're probably eating this. In the fall, they might be eating this, the summer and the winter, and then of course that would affect their pups in utero as they feed them through their own body or through their milk.
Yeah. By analyzing segments along the length of the whisker of these females, you see these oscillating patterns of isotope signatures. And what we wanted to try and explain was why. So we got a lot of samples of fish from the fisheries industry and then given to us and analyzed. So we were able to look at actual prey species and see what their isotope signatures were in that same area where the whiskers were collected and try and make that correlation between whisker signature and fish signature.
That makes sense. What's the next step?
The next step is probably tying these diet estimates to actual sea lion behaviors. We collected these whiskers, not knowing exactly where these females had been when they were growing them, what they were up to. The next step to provide more definition on what we've done would be to maybe put tracking collars on females and let them swim around and forage for a year or two, and then collect whiskers, and then we can track that back to distance from shore, or sometimes they travel a great distance and they'll change their haul-out areas. So it might be changing geography that leads to these differences in isotopes that we're seeing in the whiskers.
Tell me about the journal that you've been published in.
Ecologia. It's a high-ranked journal in the ecology world. One of the main focuses of the journals is to highlight new methodologies for studying ecological processes and ecosystems. One of the reasons why we are fortunate enough to get our work published there is because we developed a new method for analyzing this data that uses more like a home range analysis.
So you guys pioneered some research, then you were published. Will you continue to be involved in the research?
They are still capturing sea lions up in Alaska and plucking whiskers. They are also putting collars on. I've seen a little bit of that data, and we've gotten good track data of movements around their islands up there. So hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll be able to wrap all of this together and get a more comprehensive picture of what these animals are up to. The balance is really important. We as a species need to eat as well, and a lot of us like to eat fish. So there's a huge market for that. There's fisheries industries. Those fisheries have definitely impacted the resources available to these sea lions, but that's not to say that we can't better manage our practices to both benefit us and them.
Well, we certainly don't want the stellar sea lion to go the way of the stellar sea cow. What I think is really interesting is this isotope research, which you engaged in on the data end using whiskers from live pups in Alaska. There are researchers that come to you to ask for feathers, whiskers, or fur from some of our animals that we have here at the museum.
Yeah, we've definitely gotten requests for tissues for stable isotope analysis. Most of them, I think, have been involved with birds and their feathers, but we've also sent off pieces of bone and claws from both birds and mammals for stable isotope analyses to get at those location or diet kind of questions.
Will a claw give different information than a piece of fur or a piece of feather?
Each tissue represents a certain kind of timeline. For feathers, for example, they're grown during a certain period of time and then they're fixed. Some hairs are like that as well, but other hairs, like the hairs on our heads, grow continuously. Feathers, you could look what happened last spring when they grew them, but hairs, maybe you could get a whole time series from last spring to today.
I just think that's fascinating. We've been talking with Andy Dahl, Assistant Collections Manager for Zoology, about his wonderful research with stellar sea lions that could contribute to saving a beleaguered population He's also had a chance to talk to us about how the collections here at the museum are contributing to similar research on other species around the world. Andy, thank you for talking to us today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.